Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Garlic can improve metabolic syndrome. This is from University of Medical Sciences, article published in Phytotherapy Research, peer-reviewed journal. That's good news. Then we have something brand new from Montelordi in Spain, a research center, that ceramides, that's ceramides, reduces the appearance of wrinkles. Well, we're going to have to make room in our bathroom cabinets for something that's really good for us, not harmful. We take it internally, and it can help us in an anti-aging protocol. I'll discuss that. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, young women with breast cancer who opt for metastatic treatments such as mastectomies report lower quality of life. Journal of the American Medical Association, a surgery journal on that. Also today, we'll take a look at polyphenols. That's what you get when you have your berries, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, goji berries. They enhance endurance and delay the time to exhaustion. University of Burgundy in France. Also today, we'll talk about strength training can burn fat too, therefore busting the myth that only aerobic does that. University of New South Wales, which is in Australia. And also today, we'll discuss a sedentary lifestyle can lead to more nighttime hot flashes. Smith College, new study suggests that too many hours sitting on the couch could increase problematic hot flashes in midlife women. Those are some of the issues we're going to take on. But more importantly today, we're going to take a greater in-depth look at some things. For example, our first video after health and nutrition will be short. It's only 2 minutes, 40 seconds. It's the top person representing the British government in science, medicine. And I want you to watch it. So go to prn.fm, scroll down, and you can watch in real time the videos. And you hear him say that for the vast majority of people, the COVID virus is harmless. Now, hold on a second. He's speaking on behalf of the British scientific community, the medical community, and the government? Yes. We've been told just the opposite. Now, we know the virus is real. We know it can kill people and has. We know it's easily spread. These are all facts, indisputable. But then what happens when we find out, as you will later, that we've all been manipulated? Part of the Great Reset that we'll be dealing with in depth on our program this week, working on a major article. And also, over the weekend, I was able to find, and I want to thank one of the listeners out there who sent it to me. I would not have known that it even existed, except that one of the people who care about information, her name is Christy Mack, I got an email, and it's got dozens upon dozens of charts. And in those charts, those circles, are all the people within a given field who interrelate, who all have some form of professional relationship, and they control everything in there. So you start seeing the interlocking control over everything in science and medicine. But there are other interlockings in the Treasury Department and Federal Reserve working with the banking system and big agriculture. So they determine what we eat because they control the seeds. They control the farming industry, except for the small organic farms. So everything becomes better understood. Those are now posted on prn.fm and garynoll.com. So there's no conspiracy here. These are facts. The names, these organizations, all told, I'm going to say more or less around 20,000 corporations and individuals control the world. But outside of maybe 3 or 4 of the names, you've never heard of any of them. Now you will. And we're going to have a really powerful discussion today for most of the program with Whitney Webb, in my opinion, one of the finest investigative journalists on the planet. She talks very fast. She's being interviewed by Dr. Reiner Fulmich's group of lawyers. You see all these lawyers, and they're taking testimony for lawsuits going to be brought and are being brought around the world. And she is testifying, giving him insights. Again, turn off any other distracting information. Watch the interview, because she is like an encyclopedia, fast, fast, fast. But her information is accurate. She will give you a completely different perspective on the investigation into the truth of everything on this and who's behind it and what are their connections. And also then, the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, Dr. Janet Rose, now mind you, she sits on the FDA advisory panel. This is an insider's insider. This is one of the ultra-orthodox pro-vaccine people. I'm pro-vaccine. I'm pro any medical procedure that has been shown to work and be effective and non-toxic. And purely as a different philosophical approach, where all my career, the vast majority of guests I've had on, have a progressive and humanitarian approach to issues, I've intentionally excluded all complementary and alternative physicians and scientists. Instead, I've only had on and invited the most respected ultra-Orthodox, pro-vaccine, pro-Orthodox medicine, pro-science advocates on. And I've explained why. Because never in any of your lifetimes have you seen the ultra-Orthodox policy makers and opinion leaders within science and medicine fight each other. Because a group of them would not go along with all the lies, the pathological lying of Anthony Fauci and all the top scientists associated with getting his money in the universities. And I've never seen this. I just had a discussion with Richard Gale this morning in our pre-production meeting. And I said, you know, Richard, my entire life, I've tried to help the doctors and their patients. And we've succeeded with the help of just two people over a 10-year period. We went from every doctor in New York State being attacked. Warren Levin, Robert Atkins, Robert Giller, every single one for practicing alternative medicine, not for hurting their patients. To the contrary, their patients got better because they were not using standard of care, which itself was barbaric. They chose a better way. And so I would have a meeting and I couldn't get five of them together because they were afraid. They'd been shell-shocked. So they just kept their head down, didn't come to demonstrations, wouldn't say anything. So we had to fight that battle on our own, just a handful of us. But what was the outcome? Listen carefully. The only reason, I mean the only reason today that you can even get an alternative approach or see an alternative doctor, or that the 5 or 10,000 that exist are able to practice, is because we won that battle in New York. After we won the battle, then by informed consent, your doctor could take you on any of the alternative therapies, homeopathy, vitamin C, ozone, etc. So we just take that for granted. Well, don't. Because the alternative doctors didn't help us win that. They wouldn't even engage their own patients in that. That's how cowardly they were. I do not respect them as individuals. Not one of them. Yeah, not one of the alternative doctors except Martin Feldman, because he did stand up. He came to the demonstrations. You know, he wrote the articles. He advocated on his patients' behalf. But the rest of them, forget about it. In any case, they're trying to do that again today. But now, they're not fighting the alternative doctors. They're fighting each other. So let us see how the orthodox doctor fights the orthodox doctor. One is independent in their judgment. The other is controlled by a protocol-bound, profit-driven, weaponized agenda. That's what you're seeing. The media will never touch this. they will never have the people I have on, even though these are the top people in the world in their fields. So that's what we're going to see today. So we have a lot coming at you. And mind you, this is a woman you have not seen interviewed anywhere. You have not heard about her. But you're going to hear her voice in an FDA online, and it's rare. It took me a month to find it, but I found it. I found the actual conference call of the FDA determining about the vaccinating of children. So now you hear the real voices of dissent, and she's as orthodox as you get, and she goes against them. So we're going to play this truth that you're not hearing anywhere else. And tomorrow I will offer a challenge, a polite challenge, to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! On her constant, what I feel is misrepresentation of facts on ivermectin. And since I published my point of view in several articles, fully documented, and I've given the actual number of studies that exist, how many scientists are in those studies, all published in peer-reviewed literature, and how many patients, and the results and percentage of improvement, then I will send that to her with a hope that she will review it and hopefully reposition her point of view of being against ivermectin, because ivermectin saved a lot of lives, countless lives. One of the most important things you should have, sick or not, especially if you're at risk, you definitely have to have that, along with everything else that you should have. Wild oregano oil, black cumin seed oil, olive leaf extract, astragalus, bee propolis, manuka honey, vitamin C, vitamin D3, zinc, quercetin. Everybody should have that at all times and be taking that prophylactically, no matter how healthy you are. I take all that every day. So therefore, I'm not immune to getting sick or even getting COVID. I don't have it because my immune system is strong. Yours also should be strong. So just, you know, they're not telling us to do anything except take their stupid drug. And by the way, a brand new study came out on Fauci's drug of choice that he's been using from the beginning. No efficacy at all. Doesn't work. Kills people. Shuts down their kidneys. But you won't see that in the New York Times. Let's go to the latest on health and healing. And I'm going to go through this rather quickly. We all know that garlic is good. Garlic is good to gargle with if you have a cold. And by the way, one of the ways that you can kill viruses of all types in your air passages, your nose, is spray colloidal silver up your nose, both nostrils, twice a day. When I'm on an airplane, I spray my nostrils, spray around the mouth. And then one way you can do it, I would never recommend this otherwise, but it does work for this only, is to take some very strong Listerine, the original one, and gargle it and spit it out. Do that 3 times a day. That kills all the viruses in your mouth. But then when you're not traveling and you're not having to be on a plane or around people, you don't do that. Instead, you can take garlic with colloidal silver and you gargle it and swallow it. Now, we know how garlic is good at bringing down your blood pressure. We know it's good at thinning the blood. We know it's great for killing parasites in the intestine. Well, it does all that. But a new randomized clinical trial reported in Phytotherapy Research, major peer-reviewed journal, found an association between garlic and improvement in several components of metabolic syndrome. Mind you, metabolic syndrome is not a single condition. It's a cluster of factors that increase the risk of developing diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And metabolic syndrome is defined as the presence of 3 of 5 disorders: abdominal obesity, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, elevated blood sugar, and low levels of high density lipoproteins, the good cholesterol, the HDL. And they found that when they took 1,600 milligrams of garlic powder a day, and that's not a lot, for 3 months, or a placebo, the garlic supported beneficial HDL cholesterol was significantly higher than those taking placebo. Systolic and diastolic blood pressure improved. Triglyceride levels went down. Waist circumference and insulin resistance improved. Fatty liver index improved. appetite was reduced compared to placebo. So take your garlic. Now, I mentioned ceramide, C-E-R-A-M-I-D-E. And in a Spanish research, they found that by taking it orally, it reduces wrinkles, makes them less deep, fewer fine lines, and more moist, youthful skin. So some people have heard of it because it is in some moisturizers. And these are lipids. They're naturally occurring in skin, but levels decline with age. So adding ceramides as part of an anti-aging routine is important. So the oral ceramides now are what are coming in, not in skin cream, but orally, because when you get it in a skin cream, it's generally very little. When you take it, you can control how much is going into your body. So ceramides in both topical and oral formulas come from grains and help keep your skin youthful looking and soft to the touch. A double-blind study published in Life Science analyzed the water levels in the skin of individuals who took rice bran extract, which is a source of ceramides, compared to those who did not. There was a significant improvement among those who did consume the rice bran, and even on the notoriously dry skin of the elbow. So, it works. Now, this was published in the scientific journal Food and Nutrition Research. They found that four herbal extracts, when combined, improved the appearance of skin that had been damaged by pollution or other environmental irritants. What are these? Rosemary, olive leaf, lemon verbena, V-E-R-B-E-N-D-A, and Japanese pagoda tree leaf, P-A-G-O-D-A. Pagoda. And this botanical cocktail was shown to improve every clinical and biochemical parameter measured, including decreased wrinkle depth, improved elasticity, firmness, and moisturization. It even reduced the appearance of dark spots. These effects were all significant after 2 weeks. Okay, I'll repeat them. Rosemary, olive leaf, lemon verbena, and Japanese pagoda tree leaf. And the also, not to forget, that you can actually buy the ceramides. I've seen them advertised around. They're not expensive. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute comes an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Surgery that even as more young women with breast cancer opt to have mastectomies, many experience a persistent decline in their sexual and psychological well-being following the procedure because, after all, if you've had both breasts removed, that can have a very strong psychological impact, and that in turn impacts their long-term physical and emotional well-being. And this was a multi-center prospective cohort where women diagnosed with breast cancer, moderate to large quantity of life differences were apparent several years later. That's why I believe that if you're ever going to have a mastectomy for unilateral breast cancer, when breast conserving surgery was also an option, that people should first look at all the alternative cancer therapies that have been shown to work. Now, I published several articles on this, and I also went around the world and I filmed the leading alternative cancer experts. And I'm going to be editing those interviews and their protocols and the patients before and after with terminal cancer who then are cured. And I'm going to put them up online as a public service. They'll be free. As soon as I got to hire an archivist who can sit there and watch the films and know how to do what is called a paper edit. You know, so this doctor for this amount of time discuss this topic, and that way it makes it easy. I must have 50 doctors, and I want to have all of those. So before you just rush into having a radical procedure, chemotherapy, radiation, or some combination, which may or may not work, you at least know there are other opinions, other directions that can help you and not cause this mutilation of body. And if you are going to have that, there should also be programs that impact you in a positive way to allow you to adjust to the fact that your body is being changed so that you don't walk around with fear or any kind of self-deprecation because what is no longer there. So, and that happens to a lot of people. So everything that I can provide that helps you with the decision to give you more options, it'll be up there. Anyone who wants that job, it's in Florida, room and board plus a moderate pay. I don't have unlimited resources because it's cost me a lot of money up to this point just to get all my tapes from all my sources, put them all together, catalog them, archive them, and all that's been done. I've had two wonderful people who helped do that over the last 6 months, so this is the next step. It'll probably take a year to get all this done. You can go to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. If you'd like to apply that, just put down what your experience is, etc. So anyhow, that's important. And then finally, polyphenols. That's why you should have more fruits and vegetables in the diet. They enhance your endurance. Now, of course, if you're an athlete, that's very important. So you know if you eat grapes or grape juice, apples, and other fruits, you'll have more endurance. Interesting, because in every one of our long runs, we're not talking about a lot, 500 milligrams, that's a half a gram. And at every stage of the New York City Marathon, we had, oh, I guess 300, more or less, volunteers. We had a sign, Natural Living, and it would be up from the normal roadrunner signs. And we would have a glass of, three glasses. You could take coconut water, which gave you potassium, about 500 milligrams. Sometimes we put watermelon in it. Then we'd have vegetable juice and a fruit juice. And those had at least, I would say, 2,000 milligrams of polyphenols per drink. And guess what? Not a single person that trained with us did not finish the marathon. Now, over the decades, you're talking about somewhere north of 30,000 people. So we're, you know, happy about that, of all the different races. And so our experience was you just have bursts of energy every mile when you get this. And here's a study showing that, University of Burgundy in France. More polyphenols, more endurance. Less to delay time to exhaustion. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients. We're 23 minutes into the program. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, our first clip will be, it's a short clip. It's the United Kingdom's government's official statements on COVID. And boy, do they radically differ from what we've been told in the past, the beginning, middle, and up to this point, in both Great Britain, Germany, and the United States. But he's not saying this off the cuff. He's saying this is official policy. So shouldn't we adjust official policy going forward based upon what their findings are? It's just common sense. So that's coming at you. And let me just mention also that coming at you very shortly, in fact, anytime now, if you missed, and a lot of you missed it, I know, because I know how many thousands of people wanted to tune into the webinar and weren't able to because we had expanded twice. Our bandwidth couldn't go any further. But there's a 7.5-hour information-packed webinar that is now available at GaryNall.com. Everything you need to know to survive COVID, to the best that I can share that, and other experts in the field. You'll hear some of these ultra-Orthodox scientists telling you the truth about it. And then also a part of that is, let's just say you can't stay in New York for whatever reason. You'll lose your job, you don't get vaccinated, so you just decide to move. Where are the best places to move? Where will you have the most freedom? Where is it environmentally sound? So all that is presented as well. And then the premier, the second premier, the premier of Last Call for Tomorrow, the environmental film that shows you what's really going on with the environment, global warming, etc., and what to do about it individually. That'll be on October 16th at Saturday at noon, and that's up on GaryNall.com. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
KLE is a very serious epidemic. but equally the fact that actually the great majority of people will not die from this. And I'll just repeat something I said right at the beginning, because I think it's worth reinforcing. Most people, a significant proportion of people will not get this virus at all at any point in the epidemic, which is going to go on for a long period of time. Of those who do, some of them will get the virus without even knowing it. They will have the virus with no symptoms at all, asymptomatic carriage, and we know that happens. Of those who get symptoms, the great majority, probably 80%, will have a mild or moderate disease, might be bad enough for them to have to go to bed for a few days, not bad enough for them to have to go to the doctor. An unfortunate minority will have to go as far as hospital, but the majority of those will just need oxygen and will then leave hospital. And then a minority of those will end up having to go to severe and critical care, and some of those, sadly, will die. But that's a minority. It's 1% or possibly even less than 1% overall. And even in the highest risk group, this is significantly less than 20%, i.e. the great majority of people, even the very highest groups, if they catch this virus, will not die. And I've really wanted to make that point really clearly.
Do you know, for example, now how many people in the country have recovered from the virus and are now perfectly healthy again, such as the Prime Minister, for example?
Well, we have data. Obviously, you don't know everybody for the reasons Chris has said, because a large number of people have been asymptomatic or haven't gone to the doctor. But we do have recovery rates. They are available, and I see absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be made available.
Yes, we certainly have hospital recovery rates.
Yes, so we have, in a sense, what we have, and this is where I wouldn't want people to overread them, but it's important. They're perfectly open data, actually. It's perfectly possible to get hold of them if people want, is we have data on the people who got as far as hospital, how many of those left hospital. But of course, they're at the very severe end of the spectrum. All the ones I was talking about before that point, they make a full recovery, they don't enter the statistics. Now, they increasingly will enter the statistics now that we have a better testing capacity that means that we're picking out more of the milder cases in the community. But I think what, you know, if people look at those, to go back to your point, what I wouldn't want is for people then to say, oh, well, that's the mortality rate is higher than I expected. That's because the recovery rates we have are for people who are severe enough to get to hospital. And that's that is a majority. So it is important that in a sense it's read in that context.
Thanks very much.
Okay. That's official position. Not covered anywhere. Because it would change the idea, continue to scare people and say another lockdown. In Australia, it's become, oh my God, it's a completely totalitarian state. Those people have lost their minds and power there. And the public are fighting back. I don't believe they're fighting back in the right way. But you got to understand, the more power you give any organization or individual over your life, the less you have for yourself. But here's what you should hear what he said. He's saying 1% or less. That matches the annual normal death rate. In fact, now, this week, I'm going to have the world's leading authority on graphing yearly death rates. The latest statistics shows, and you see all the charts published in peer-reviewed journals, you'll see the charts have not changed. In fact, the average death time of a person with COVID all throughout Europe was actually longer than their normal lifespan. In some countries, I'll go country by country, 80.5 years, 82 years, 84 years, they were dying. Now they're reevaluating those death certificates and the autopsies. And guess what they found? In one country, I'll just give it right off the bat. In Italy, they found that over 95% of all the deaths occurred in people who died from their underlying normal comorbidities. Cancer, emphysema, congestive heart failure, etc. They didn't die from COVID, though they may have had COVID as an antibody reaction. But then again, they were using the PCR test, and that in all likelihood was a false positive. So then a group of individuals that you will find out in a moment said, okay, let's use a completely failed model, a mathematical model, out of Great Britain, out of a university there. And let's scare the world and say, this is how many thousands and hundreds of thousands or millions of people are going to die. And so everyone freaked out. And they used that. That's what led to the lockdowns. There was no need for any lockdowns. In fact, countries that didn't lock down did something else. They were afraid they were going to be overwhelmed So they had in Sweden and other countries, including in the United States, we just found this out over the weekend, do not resuscitate instructions. But in some countries like Great Britain, that meant do not resuscitate, do not give water or food. People starved to death. They dehydrated to death. We have the proof of that. We have whistleblowers who are going to be talking about that. They're watching it. And then they gave them a drug. In Great Britain, 100,000 doses were ordered of a particular drug that is used in hospice care to speed up a person's death without the pain. It is a sedative, but it's a massively deadly sedative. And they were giving it to it with intention until it was exposed. Then suddenly, all those deaths that were spiking up, those were all people who didn't have COVID who were in nursing homes because they wanted to make room for younger people in the hospitals. So they just killed off the older people. That's murder. And that was done in Sweden. That was done in Great Britain. It was done in the United States. We have the proof of that. We have whistleblowers. You'll hear them. You'll see them. So just want to let you know that how everything about COVID has been a lie, except that it's a virus that can kill people and it's easily spread. Those three things are true. Everything else is not. Now, let's take a look at a ultra-orthodox person, what she has to say. Listen carefully what she's saying. This is on a conference call with all FDA people on advising on vaccine for children. This is Dr. Jessica Rose, R-O-S-E.
My name is Dr. Jessica Rose, and I'm a viral immunologist and computational biologist. I've taken it upon myself to become a VAERS analyst, to organize the data into comprehensive figures, to convey information to the public in both published work and video mediums. Safety and efficacy are the cornerstones of the development and administration of biological products meant for human use. Risk is a measure of the probability of an adverse event occurring and the severity of the resultant harm to health of individuals in a defined population. Safety is a judgment of the acceptability of this risk in a specified situation. Efficacy is the probability of benefit to individuals in a defined population from a medical technology. Refer to slide one. This is a bar plot that shows the past 10 years of VAERS data plotted against the total number of adverse event reports for all vaccines for the years 2011 through 2020 and for COVID-associated products only for 2021. The left bar plot represents all adverse event reports, and the right bar plot represents all death adverse event reports. There's an over 1,000% increase in the total number of adverse events for 2021, and we are not done with 2021. This is highly anomalous on both fronts. These increased reporting rates are not due to increased rates in injection and not due to simulated reporting. This has been shown using a comparative analysis of influenza data. The onus is on the public health officials, the FDA, the CDC, and policymakers to answer to these anomalies and acknowledge the clear risk signals emerging from VAERS data and to confront the issue of COVID injectable product use risks that, in my opinion, outweigh any potential benefit associated with these products, especially for children. Slide two. This is a time series plot that shows the total cumulative number of cardiovascular, immunological, and neurological adverse events for 2021 associated with COVID products. When the cumulative absolute counts are normalized to the total number of fully injected individuals in the U.S., we can see that 1 in 660 individuals are succumbing to and reporting immunological adverse events associated with the COVID products. The underreporting factor is not considered here. Slide three. This is a phylogenetic tree showing the emergence of the alpha and delta variants of COVID-19 over time. The emergence of both of these variants and their subsequent clustering arose in very close temporal proximity to the rollout of the COVID products in Israel. Israeli data from the Ministry of Health and Our World in Data reveals that 98.1% of the
that the vaccine for children would cause more harm than the virus itself. And now we're seeing it. Even this morning, one of the attendees at the anti-aging, we're wrapping up our anti-aging clinical study on meditative practices, a person said that their relative had a young teenager get the vaccine because the mother was pressured by her work to have a vaccine where she couldn't work. And as a result, she decided to go ahead and get the kid because the kid was in school. So went ahead and got the kid vaccinated. The kid died the next day of a heart attack. 16 years old. All right. That's not reported anywhere. 99% of adverse reactions are not reported. And yet her chart, and if you went to PRN.fm, scroll down to Gary's notes, you would see that for 20 years, the death rate and adverse event rate were almost very small. And now suddenly this huge spike in deaths. And that's, she said, you heard her say, didn't you? That this does not count under reporting. Now multiply that times 10. All right? And I'm being generous. I'm giving it a 10%. Harvard said 1%, in which case you can multiply it by 99. And you would have an astronomical through-the-roof chart. So the actual number of dead in America exceed the total death from the Vietnam War and the Korean War. That's terrible. And injuries. So we're dealing with hiding the numbers, not being honest about the numbers. That in itself is a whole topical investigation. I'd like to see the citizen journalists in this audience go to work on that and see what you can find. The evidence is now overwhelming because now we have the experience of looking back, and now scientists upon scientists are coming out of the woodwork and doctors saying, I used ivermectin quietly and not a single patient went to the hospital. I used ivermectin. Patients were in the hospital, got out of the hospital. Very few died. And other, not just by itself, but other nutrients as well. None of that advocated by the Surgeon General, head of the U.S. Public Health Service, Anthony Fauci. And why aren't they looking at Anthony Fauci? Honestly, compare what he did in his failed and murderous reign as heading with Gallo, the war on AIDS, and how many died because he refused to acknowledge a Bactrim, a drug that would have helped people with pneumocystis, the number one killer for a long time of people with AIDS. We did. We offered Bactrim at the Tri-State Healing Center. Oh, and by the way, 1,200 patients, not one died. Every single one lived. And we followed them for 15 years. And we were able to overcome. We had so many people in there each day that we had to open at 8 in the morning, close at night, and I didn't charge a single penny to anyone who had AIDS who was being treated. You think that information's out there anywhere? No. You think that they would come and see what we were doing that they couldn't achieve? No. That's the world we live in. So now what we're going to do is this. For the remainder of the program, you're going to hear, in my opinion, one of the top three investigative journalists in the world, Whitney Webb. Got to listen carefully. Watch what she says. Go to PRN.fm and watch it. Because I've got her on for a whole hour next Tuesday night. Not this Tuesday night, not tomorrow night. I've got that already booked. But next Tuesday, Whitney Webb for a whole hour deconstructing the people behind the power of COVID and how they're profiting from it, their lack of science, and the corruption that's endemic. Now you're going to hear from her right now. She's being interviewed by a group of lawyers at the what is tentatively known as the Nuremberg II trials. They've been in session every day for a year and a half, interviewing the top scientists and doctors in the world, all with evidence, and now the lawsuits begin. Now to that clip.
And by what means and so on?
Well, I guess I would first of all point to YouTube's parent company, Google, which, among other things, is invested directly in the AstraZeneca vaccine through Vaccitech, and also more broadly, this push by Silicon Valley to basically remake the healthcare system entirely, and a lot of this about moving to telemedicine and basically changing the normal paradigm of medical care. They're invested in that specifically because they, along with Microsoft and some of these other companies, are looking to move healthcare, basically replace doctors with artificial intelligence apps and things like that. There's efforts underway in the UK, where I am, for example, to replace the NHS, the National Health Service, with something called NHSX, which is basically an app along these lines that they're seeking to basically, replace the existing medical system with down the line. And they had plans to do this, of course, before COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S. as well, the former head of Google, Eric Schmidt, was in charge of the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence in the U.S. And that they had a presentation that they authored in 2019. It didn't come out until a year later or so, but basically said that the big changes they needed to see in the implementation, widespread implementation of emerging technologies, including AI, needed to happen in healthcare first. And of course, we've seen that happen, over the course of the past year or so.
So they're using healthcare as a kind of a crowbar to get full control.
Yeah, well, I think that's where they start. They've started to sort of reimagine healthcare as a way of taking control and over people's lives, telling them it's for the benefit of the public, the collective, for public mm-hmm. health, and also their personal health. Whereas it's really a way to sort of implement sort of these more transhumanist or technocratic technologies under the guise of it being a health related venture. And Google, of course, is intimately invested in all of this, and they're actually partnered on a lot of this directly with the U.S. military. So the fact that they're censoring stuff that, goes against the narrative that they want to put forth on matters relating to public health, whether it's COVID-19 or really anything else, really shouldn't surprise anyone.
This is what was that? Google is invested in AstraZeneca.
Yeah. So the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, they've been publicly framing for a long time as nonprofit. That's not exactly true, because the two developers of that at the Jenner Institute at Oxford, Sarah Gilbert and Adrian Hill, have a company on which the technology of that vaccine is based called Vaccitech. And Google Ventures is one of the main investors in that company, which is set to make a lot of profits as soon as they decide that the pandemic from their perspective has ended, which they can make that declaration, they can make as a company whenever they feel like it, really.
Because before I forget, what is your background? I saw a couple of videos with you. One of them was an interview with Bobby Kennedy, for example. And I know mm-hmm. you're maybe that's your real job. You're a investigative journalist, right?
Yeah. So I started off being a staff writer for Mint Press News, which is a U.S.-based media outlet. I eventually became their senior investigative reporter. I did a series on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal that got a lot of buzz. I ended up leaving in the beginning-ish of 2020. And sort of started doing my own thing, though I did partner with a website that's also mainly a YouTube channel called The Last American Vagabond as a, mm-hmm. As a partnership when I first sort of left Mint Press.
Okay. I didn't quite understand. How does this work? How can they end the pandemic? And what happens if they say this is the end? Vaccitech, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it's how they set this up. So they just declare it as that. They can do that as a company, but they don't necessarily have to publicly say if that's the case or not. And then they can begin generating more profit than they have been off of the AstraZeneca vaccine candidate. Mm-hmm. I should mention also that in addition to Google, the UK government is also directly invested in Vaccitech and is expected to make a profit off of that vaccine, despite, how it was presented to the public. And then the other main stakeholder is Bravos Capital, which, if I'm not mistaken, was set up by the former head of global equity trading at Deutsche Bank. So those are the people that
fits right in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also here, that this CureVac, which holds the patents on the BioNTech mm-hmm. Pfizer vaccine, the German government had also invested a lot of money into that.
Not surprising.
No, in okay. CureVac.
Yeah, CureVac is owned, I think 20% of the shares is owned by the German mm-hmm. government. And they seem to be the patent holder to the vaccine. I forget the name.
Well, that would be the Pfizer vaccine and the BioNTech,
yeah.
One.
BioNTech, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So is that all? I mean, we have now three shareholders or people or companies that have invested in Vaccitech. We have Bravos Capital with Deutsche Bank.
Well, technically the Bravos Capital investment is through something called Oxford Science Innovation. And Bravos Capital is the main shareholder of that.
Okay.
Right. So they sort of hide it in a few ways.
And then there's the UK government and and there's Google.
Google Ventures. Yeah. There's the Sequoia Capital Chinese branch.
Uh-huh.
And Fosun Pharma, which I believe is a Chinese pharmaceutical company.
How's that spelled?
Welcome Trust also.
The Welcome Trust also. Everyone.
Yeah, well, Wellcome Trust is intimately involved with the AstraZeneca vaccine, period. They're the institution most involved with them to a significant degree. And they have some pretty disturbing eugenicist links that we can get into if those are of interest. But it's through Oxford Science Innovations, one of the Wellcome Trust investment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got it. Das müssen wir kurz übersetzen. Also, so is this... This is something that I have never heard before. I mean, Viviana has obviously heard of this before, but is this one of the major vehicles that we're discussing right now in the context of this vaccine scheme, Vaccitech?
Well, it's specifically for the technology used in the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. And of course, they plan to use more vaccines with that. And a lot of this is the vaccines produced by the Jenner Institute are intimately linked to Vaccitech because the people that run that institute are also the people that founded Vaccitech. And Vaccitech is actually in Africa right now. Well, sorry, the Jenner Institute and a vaccine that's tied to Vaccitech is conducting trials on really young children in Africa right now for a universal malaria vaccine. They say it started last December. And they have quite a nasty track record. The Jenner Institute, led by Adrian Hill, who developed the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, with being not quite honest with parents about the risks of the vaccine and trials. I believe it was in South Africa. About 7 infants died, and they lied about the risk. They knew in advance the vaccine was ineffective before they did the trial, but they just did it anyway. And, you know, of course, their conclusion of that trial was that it was ineffective, even though they knew that well in advance.
They knew that well in advance, and they still went forward with this.
Yeah, this was in 2009. So they have a track record of being very dishonest with their trials. They also hid results of animal trials from parents.
What's the Jenner Institute? What's the general purpose and how long have they been around?
Well, okay, so originally they were a public-private partnership with GlaxoSmithKline in the UK government in the 1990s, and then eventually GlaxoSmithKline pulled out and they were essentially remade, and I believe they were reopened in 2005. They're essentially one of the main vehicles at Oxford University for vaccine development, but also more broadly for UK vaccine funding research in general, because the head of the Jenner Institute, Adrian Hill, is also the chief person at the UK Vaccine Network, which decides which vaccine technology to research, what vaccines to fund, and what vaccines to give to the population, but also not just in the UK, but globally through vaccine philanthropy.
Okay.
And the Jenner Institute is sort of seemingly independent, or like you said, public-private partnership.
It's part of Oxford University. It used to be. It was originally a public-private partnership, but GlaxoSmithKline removed themselves at some point. GlaxoSmithKline, by the way, is also intimately tied to the Wellcome Trust, which again is very much connected to the Jenner Institute because the company the Wellcome Trust is named for Henry Wellcome, and part of GlaxoSmithKline. Before the 1990s, when they merged with Glaxo, was the company Burroughs Wellcome, which is where the Wellcome Trust essentially comes from. So,
okay, let me translate this because
that's a lot of info.
That's all right.
Sorry.
But To summarize this, this seems to be the crowd that pushes AstraZeneca, but then there's another crowd probably around the Gates Foundation. Here's the Wellcome Trust about around the Gates Foundation that's pushing the mRNA vaccines. Is that correct?
Yes, but it's slightly different. So if you've noticed how this has played out over time, the AstraZeneca vaccine has largely been banned in most developed countries, yes, or in developed countries, they've restricted its use, keeping it mainly for the elderly, which is the case in the UK, though there are some countries that have banned it outright. But however, COVAX, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the Gates-backed effort to vaccinate the developing world, relies almost entirely on AstraZeneca, despite the fact that there's been all these findings that have led governments in developed countries not to use it. But it's still considered safe for Africa, for Latin America, for Southeast Asia, India, you know. So clearly that's a considerable double standard. And when you look into the history of the Wellcome Trust and also the Gates Foundation and essentially experimenting on the developing world in things that predate COVID-19 considerably, it doesn't paint a very nice picture. But also more broadly, the pharmaceutical industry does this. For example, with the polio vaccine, there in most of the developed world now, it's an inactivated polio virus. It was previously a live virus, polio vaccine, and the live polio vaccine was not discontinued despite the evidence showing it was causing more polio cases than it prevents. It's actually still widely used in the developing world, including where I used to live in Chile.
So. Okay, I got that.
Okay, I have another question. This Moderna and Johnson and Johnson, are these sort of backup vaccines, or like, well, how do they play into this larger picture?
So I know a lot more about the AstraZeneca vaccine because I did a really long report on it that actually got me deplatformed from Patreon. They tried to take away like all my
Patreon
income
even.
Over it. Yeah. So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, how it was developed itself and its background, I don't exactly know. But Johnson & Johnson has a really bad track record as well that I think should be pretty obvious to anyone that looks into large pharmaceutical companies. I think by and large, the mRNA vaccines, they weren't for some reason used more in the developed world than the developing world, because that's how it's played out to a significant degree thus far. But, you know, they could be backup vaccines. I don't exactly know because, frankly, we don't know the long-term effects of these vaccines. So I think, a more accurate answer to that question will probably come, within the coming months or years. But I do think it is significant that Johnson & Johnson specifically was being manufactured in the U.S. by a company called Emergent BioSolutions, which previously was called Bioport and was essentially created as a fusion of a spinoff of Porton Down of the U.K. They're like biodefense, bioweapons lab in the United Kingdom. With the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. military under Ronald Reagan is essentially how that company came to be. They, as I did in a whole series last year, were intimately involved in what happened with the 2001 anthrax attacks because it was basically the only way they were going to manage to save their mandatory for U.S. military personnel anthrax vaccine program. And of course, they've been involved in scandals really ever since then to a significant degree, but were chosen to manufacture it despite that. And the person they put in charge of their quality control at this facility that was manufacturing these Johnson & Johnson vaccines has no experience in that at all, or really in the field of any sort of pharmaceutical or development or chemistry or anything. His background is being head of military intelligence teams for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and is also an expert on Iran and North Korea. It really doesn't make sense why he'd be in charge of that. But of course, more recently, the scandal that's developed in the U.S. with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that these batches were ruined, they say, basically unusable. And who knows what would have happened to people if that had been widely used. But it's very interesting that this is the company that manufactured that vaccine. Of course, they gave Johnson & Johnson a pass on that, and the blame has been placed on Emergent BioSolutions. But of course, nothing has really been done to them as a company. They're intimately connected to the U.S. military and also to the CIA and military contractor in Ohio, Battelle, which has a lot of ties to the anthrax attacks as well.
Okay. we're going to say goodbye to our BAI audience, excuse me, WBAI audience, and we're going to continue on to the top of the hour. But now it's your opportunity to call in and share your points of view. You heard her. Now, mind you, I'm going to have her on for an hour going through not the discrepancies in COVID, but rather who's behind the scenes that you heard, all the interlocking boards and their agendas. One of these companies alone is supposed to be making an additional $22 billion this year just by vaccinating children who do not need it. You heard the woman on the FDA's advisory panel. Have you heard her interviewed on CNN or any other source? No. Have you heard anyone debating her about her credentials? No. They just don't allow that information out. So we provide a voice for the voiceless. Now, you can call in at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And because Whitney Webb gives you so much information and it's accurate that it can kind of be overwhelming. She has a very fast way of speaking about this. We want to slow it down and really emphasize what this is all about. Because if you think COVID's bad, COVID is nothing compared to what we're going to be faced with the Great Reset and the digital identity cards, where you have to have both your vaccine and all of your currency on one card. You also heard her talk at the beginning about the big problem is these companies are all invested in transhumanism, artificial intelligence. Think of all the kids going to school today who have not the insight, nor do they choose to look to see that in all probability, the majority of their fields, except for, you know, medicine or nursing, is going to be done by artificial intelligence. Well, then what's the purpose of going to that school? What's going to be your career if artificial intelligence or transhumanism will take its place? We're not having these dialogues. What's happening when we have 903% debt over gross domestic product? We're bankrupt. We'll never pay our bills. Then why aren't we discussing that? Why aren't we having open and honest discussions on being the world and history's largest debtor nation? But there's no discussion of that. Why not? Because those in power wouldn't like the outcome if people know the consequences to giving the rich more money and everyone else less. So, your thoughts, 888-874-4888, and we'll see if we have a caller coming in, and I'll ask Rodney in New York. Rodney, do we have anyone on the line? Gwen from New York. Gwen, it's your turn.
Hi, Gary. Thank you. You're so fantastic, and I adore Whitney Webb. I wanted to tell you that I was listening to the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC this morning, and he was attempting to interview people that are not taking the mandatory vaccine who are medical workers. And what is sorely lacking is that even people that call up can't really explain why they're not taking the vaccine. And I would love to see somebody like you be interviewed or spar with Brian Lehrer, because he doesn't know what he's talking about at all. And he was talking about the Israel study as if it was a study that showed that the vaccine was working beautifully over there. But in fact, that is not what the study was showing. The study was showing that it wasn't working and that many more people are going into the hospital and getting sick from the COVID virus due to the vaccine. So the thing is, we have such an onsurge of propaganda and false information. And clear voices like Whitney Webb's and yours are so hard to come by that the public, although a lot of them just say, I don't trust this, but they don't really know why. There's a lot of people that do and will not take it because of the information they have and the clear information. And unfortunately or fortunately, you're the only station that really is stacking it up every day. I mean, I tell people all the time that the COVID vaccine is a moving story. It moves along every single day. So if you listen to Gary Knoll, you will hear that there is news every single day on this. And yet we keep getting the same things over and over again. So I was just wondering, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I was wanted to pitch this to the Brian Lehrer show, to have you on to discuss it.
I am open to debating anyone on any of the topics I discuss at any time. I have no fear of that. understand something. Just look today. You heard one of the top person in speaking on medical issues and COVID issues from Great Britain saying that we have 1% or less mortality from COVID. Then how does that become a pandemic? The original model, the original mathematical model that was presented to the world, which has been completely debunked by the epidemiologists, including a Nobel Prize winner from Stanford University, showed that he was off by multiple factors, not just a little off, hugely off. But everyone went ahead for the lockdown based upon him being accurate. He was not at the Imperial College. Now, you heard the woman who sat on the FDA advisory board. You heard her speak. She said that there will be more injuries from the vaccine. When she said product, that was vaccine, than from COVID in younger people. And therefore, she's adamantly opposed to vaccinating younger people with COVID vaccine. So these are mainstream people. They don't have them on. Brian Lehr should have them on first. I'm happy to debate him on any issue because just like I'm going to offer a polite but legitimate challenge to Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, where she is, remember, she was for the white helmets. She was for removal of Assad in Syria. I was not. And okay, that's her right. I don't deny her right. But in look back, they were wrong. Everyone who supported the removal of Gaddafi, they were wrong. Supported the weapons of mass destruction, wrong. So the things that they have supported, they've been wrong on. Why are they not held accountable for what they're wrong? Because I can assure you, if I was wrong on something, oh, they would make that a big issue. So we have a double standard in accountability. We have a double standard in who we're using as resources for making statements. But also, here's what they're not getting in Brian Lehr. They screen their calls. We do not. If someone wants to get on the air and say something, and if you've heard them, you know, I don't have to align with them, and I don't just shut people off. I thank them. You let them have a chance to say what they have to say. That's what a free society does that supports free speech, not censored speech, not cherry-picked speech, like Biden getting up and reading a cue card saying, now I'm supposed to ask the person from NBC a question. That's absurd. That's how stage-managed everything is. But the reason that the doctors and nurses do not want to be vaccinated is not because they're anti-vax. They've taken vaccines. They've taken all kinds of vaccines to work in that medical system. It's because they've seen the side effects. They've seen the people coming in who were healthy, who are now disabled permanently, dead, who shouldn't be. They're seeing this, and they're not seeing that being passed up the line to the Barris system. They see the corruption in the system. And they're not going to put themselves or their family in harm's way. And the largest group that is saying no to the vaccine as a group are African Americans. And now within, there's now a movement by the unions in New York, the school teachers, to have freedom of choice, which is good. And a judge upheld that rule. So now they don't have to get vaccinated. What does New York media do? Attacks them as being, you know, just Trump right-wing conspirators. No, the union, the school teachers union, is very liberal, democratic controlled forever. And so now they've run out of ways of punishing people. So now they're eating their own. So now if you're a unionist, historically liberal and democrat, and you want your freedom of choice, you're one of these undesirables. You're one of the Trump people. That's how far they've gone. Next thing they'll say is that we'll see a commentary possibly in the New York Times saying that all the unionists in New York, school teachers who voted to have freedom of choice and not be mandated, they were Russian agents. I mean, these people are absurd. They go to such lengths. I understand the issue, but unfortunately, Brian Lehr possibly does not have the same access because he has given his information. He doesn't go out and originate it. There's a big difference there. I appreciate your call. Thank you. We're out of time, everyone. Stay tuned right now for Utrecht Lead.